Jesus told us a parable. Behold the fig tree and all the trees. As soon as they put forth leaves, you see it. You know for yourselves that summer is near. So also, when you see these things happening, the fig tree and all the trees, recognize what? The kingdom of God is near. Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will not pass away. The implication of this word, behold, means to stare, to study, to know, to be aware, to consider, to have knowledge about, to look, to perceive, to be sure about. And you know what else it means? It means to tell about it. Believe it or not, this word behold somehow has that meaning. So, remember what the mission of John the Baptist was? What was it? He was the voice crying in the wilderness. What was he crying? You know, when the scribes and Pharisees sent the rulers in Jerusalem sent their disciples to find out what John was doing, what did John do? All he did was quote from Isaiah, tell them that I am the voice crying in the wilderness and making ready the way of the Lord. And he quotes the whole thing. You think that he would leave out the last part of it, but he didn't. He says, make ready the way of the Lord, make his path straight. Every valley shall be filled, every mountain and hill shall be brought low, and the crooked will become straight, and the rough ways smooth. And then the punchline. And all flesh will see it. See what? The salvation of our God. This was what the commission of John was. And a couple of verses later, after he condemns the scribes and Pharisees and tells the soldiers, when they ask him, what do we do to have eternal life, and he says, don't stop cheating people and stop beating them up and all that. And then the next verse says, the people were in a state of expectation. You go to Israel today, or you go among, outside of our fellowship among Bible-believing evangelicals, you'll see they're in a state of expectation. Of what? Of the return of Jesus or the manifestation of the Messiah. I wish I could play for you Rabbi Benjamin Black right now telling how he believes in his lifetime the Messiah would return. He was 70 years old. This was about 10 or 11 years ago. He made this YouTube video. Just search for 6,000 years, Benjamin Black, on YouTube and look at his YouTube. He says, I believe Messiah will return in my lifetime. Why? The religious Jews believe Messiah comes before the end of 6,000 years, not after the beginning. They believe, just like we do, that 6,000 years, there'll be 1,000 years of their Messiah, just like us. Benjamin Black could give this discourse today from a different standpoint. But I am so happy to have David here. I'm glad the Lord has taken him from his comfort zone in San Diego and brought him here to our snowstorm. So again, he wants you to ask questions, so don't raise your hand at any point. But at the end, he's leaving 10 or 15 minutes for every question in the room to be asked. Ask the hard questions of him. Ask him, you know, why? Why he thinks he needs to modify Brother Russell's chronology. But from my standpoint, the Jews, you know what year the Jews are in? 5779. So they believe 6,000 years ends in about 220 some odd years. Bible students, under the adopted chronology that Brother Russell adopted, think that 1874 is the time of the ending of the 6,000 year. Let's listen to David, give him a chance here, to show us perhaps why 6,000 years is future from today.
Okay. Well, first, thank you. Thank you for being here and coming. Now I hear myself echoing here. So, you know, if I ever hear a recording of my own voice, I wonder how anybody can listen to me, to be honest. So I'm hearing that recording in real time. I'm hearing that feedback right now. This is the booklet that Brother Paul Agnew requested of us some time ago. And Paul knows my views, so he knows what I might say. That's not the title that Paul originally thought it might carry. Originally, he thought it might carry something like the prophetic time or the time of prophecy, something like that. But I think this is the best title, and I'm glad you changed it. But this is a booklet that was prepared heavily involved with time features, heavily involved with time features. So it's impossible to review our expectations about Israel in this booklet without getting deeply involved in things that impact our understanding of time features. Now, Paul mentioned the fact that some of the time features here are a little different than you're going to find in Volume 2. Yes, they are, but I'd like to clarify a little bit. Last night, in some of our fellowship at Adrian's home with Patricia and Adrian, we were having a little discussion, and this has come to pass before, where brethren who are earnest about Brother Russell and his opinion sometimes feel that they know his opinion on a point so earnestly that sometimes they're a little insistent upon it. And they will sometimes discount other things because they feel they got the point, they got the truth. And it seems to me that among those dear brethren that emphasize Brother Russell so strongly, because, believe it or not, I'm among them, that I think the point they need to know is everything that Brother Russell said about a subject, and sometimes there are surprises in what he said about the very subjects that we think we understand his opinion on. Now, if you look at the question book under a variety of assorted questions that are kind of tangent to some of the prophetic areas that we have, you'll find different opinions at different times on interesting questions that show he had a breadth of options before him. Sometimes he even said, well, I'm not sure, but, you know, this is what I think now, and later he might either firm it up or retrace his steps. On the subject of the 1,000 years, I think the brethren, if they really research deeply, as Brother George has, I don't know if anybody has researched Brother Russell on this point more than Brother George, will find things that are expressly and earnestly stated that are not what you might suppose from a reading of Volume 2. Now, we're going to talk about that a little bit. Now, this booklet, of course, is intended for a Jewish audience. You know how many times the word Jesus appears in this booklet? Precious few. If you thought zero, you're right. Okay. This is for a Jewish audience. And someday, when the ancient worthies come back, they're going to be much more persuasive than we are, and they're going to accept Jesus wholeheartedly. But until then, this gives a glimmer of hope for them. But you're not a Jewish audience, you're a Christian audience. Lee, maybe you're a Jewish Christian, but you're pretty much mostly us Gentiles here, you know, but all Christians. So I'm going to introduce what talking about some Christian precepts before we get right into the point of the book. And it's going to be about Brother Russell thought, what he thought about this period of time, about the millennium. Now, when you look in about the year 1900 in the reprints, you will find something there that I think you all may have heard about, but maybe we don't focus on it so much. It's a question written. It's in the reprint number that David Stein allowed me to memorize. It was your clue that told me how to memorize this. 2739. Now, why is that memorable? What's the New Testament, Old Testament? That's it. 27 books in the New Testament, 39 in the Old Testament. So I'll never forget it now that I've got that key. And it's simply a question to Brother Russell. You know, you've said, well, maybe something about 1872, about 1878, about 19... Tell me just exactly, when does the thousand years begin? And his answer is very surprising. He says, there's something about this subject we don't understand. Now, immediately, if you just read that part and you close the book, you already can understand something of the breadth of opinion that the Brotherhood has experienced for the last 50 years or more on this question. Because if he expresses that with all that he knew and wrote, there's something about this that's not being properly understood. Because it's not time and the Lord has not revealed it to us, well, then we should all be a little bit cautious. Now, I want to introduce a text here. I'll get right back to that article in a minute. There's more to say about it. But you know James 3:17. James 3:17, the wisdom from above is first pure. That goes to our thoughts. They should always be pure. And secondly, peaceable. But it's the third item I want to mention here. Now, James, I think, really puts into his writings a lot of things that his cousin, I think it was his cousin Jesus, had expressed before him. And Jesus talked about pure of heart and peaceable as that couplet in the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes. So I think that's where James starts off. But James, the third point is something that I don't remember Jesus expressly saying. So I would say that comes from James' experience. The word is gentle. The wisdom from above is gentle. But if you look at that word in Vine's Expository Dictionary, it doesn't mean what we mean by gentle. It means sweetly reasonable. It's the word epikes. It means a mind that is open to evidence and thought and reason. And James follows that up directly with easily entreated, and then full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, without hypocrisy. Now, I like that James text so much, I have made an effort to memorize it. So if I just spiel this off quickly and you wonder, how does he know that? It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy. But I made an effort to memorize that. And it's that third point that I think all the brethren should always keep in mind. Sweet reason. Because with sweet reason, even if we don't arrive at the same conclusion, if that's true, we'll still have a respect for one another and our opinions. But sweet reason, more than often, can induce us to come to a common appreciation. Now let's get back to that article, 2739. At the end of the article, Brother Russell quotes Revelation 20, verse 4. They lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. And he says, unambiguously, this cannot begin until all of the jewels are complete. Now I'm sitting in front of a whole audience full of jewels, and we're still waiting for the completion of the jewel class. And that was his opinion, that the 1,000 years that he quoted in Revelation 20, verse 4, not maybe, not if, not perhaps, his opinion, will not begin until the saints are complete. Now, you know, many years I've had a different opinion on the subject that I embrace now. And I knew that article was there. I remember giving a talk expressing that the 1,000 years had begun with our Lord's return at the beginning of the harvest. And I remember a sweet sister came up to me, younger than me, but now gone beyond the veil to her reward. And she showed me her Bible. She opened it, and she had this article papered into her Bible. She says, I live by that. And I knew that article existed. But you know what I thought? I thought he was wrong. And now I think he is right. Now, when you look closely at everything that Brother Russell wrote on the subject of Revelation 20, verse 4 and verse 6, I'm going to make a claim here. Brother George can challenge me because he has more experience in this than me. But I would say that I don't know of a single instance where he cites that scripture, either verse 4 or verse 6, and says, this begins at any other time other than the time when the saints are complete and the kingdom begins. Now, Brother George has looked at that more than I. My own father has looked at these things more than I. I mean, he researched copiously. I think Brother Gilbert and Brother George are the two that have researched the writings of Brother Russell on this question, perhaps more than any other. George, do you find an exception to what I just said? Revelation 20 or verse 6, quoted and applied. Does he ever apply it any other way?
I don't believe so.
And I think that that's correct. And I have looked, not as copiously as Brother George, but I think it's fair to say. So why is it that all the brethren seem to think that Brother Russell had a different opinion and therefore formed their opinions that way? Well, it's because of the opinion in Volume 2 that 6,000 years will end, or did end, rather, about 1874, and that word is about is justified because it's not precise. So where did that view come from? Why didn't he always say the 1,000 years began there? What happened to change things? First of all, where did that view come from? Brother Russell was an associate of Brother Barber early on. Now, Brother Russell came to his views about the divine plan and the two ages of redemption independent of Brother Barber. So what we understand of the chart of the ages and the harmony of the divine plan did not come from another, you know, so it was built up through other studies on the shoulders of giants, as it were, but it did not come from Brother Barber. What came from Brother Barber was his prophetic chronological thinking, because Brother Barber was a student of Brother Miller. Brother Barber was a younger contemporary of Brother Miller. Brother Barber was an older contemporary of Brother Russell. He was the connecting link. And Brother Russell had seen that Brother Barber had published in writing in a magazine that he believed that Jesus had already returned. And this keyed Brother Russell's thought, because Brother Russell had already come to the opinion that whenever the Lord would return, it would be invisible and secret and known only to his followers. That's quite a step of understanding. So when he saw the publication, maybe that time has come. Okay, I want to hear more about this. So he made an engagement with Brother Barber to meet him in Philadelphia in 1876. He says, I met him, he showed me the evidence, I accepted it. And we know that in that same year, Brother Russell actually published an article somewhere about the ending of the Gentile times that he would have picked up from Brother Barber. So where did Brother Barber get the idea that 6,000 years was ended? He got that concept from Brother William Miller. Because William Miller's his foundational concept about the Lord's return was that it would be at the cleansing of the sanctuary at the end of the 2300 days of Daniel. And he thought, for various reasons, that that was 1843. Now, the brethren have adjusted that a couple of years here or there. I actually think Brother Miller actually had the right date for the ending of the 2300 years, 1843. If you thought that that was right, what would you do next? You'd look at the other time prophecies and see how they all formed. And so Brother Miller expected that the 1260 years of papacy ended in about 1798. Now, we've adjusted that 1 year. I think our adjustment is correct. I think it's 1799. I won't go into all the reasons for that, but 1798 is the date he had. So he wanted the 1290 and the 1260 days to end at the same time. So he backed up 30 years to start the 1290. And that's where he started the 1335, which take you to the Lord's return. That would bring you to 1843, you see, for the 1335. So now, if you were of that opinion and you felt that all of these things about the very end take you to 1843, and if you thought that it was important that 6,000 years are meaningful in God's plan, what would you think of doing? Looking for a way that 6,000 years would end in 1843. And Brother Miller did just that. He found a way to make 6,000 years end. Now, I've tried to research that a little bit and find out, how did he reason this? How did he think it? And after looking as much as I could find, which isn't everything perhaps that's out there, my opinion is that the way he did it was reverse engineering. He concluded it ended in 1843. He backfilled. He didn't have all the facts, but he backfilled enough to kind of deduce, well, this must be this way to make it end this way. Now, put yourself in the mind of Brother Barber. Things have not turned out the way you all expected. All of the Adventists expected the Lord to return in 1843. They readjusted, you know, give a year leeway there. Then they focused on, what was it, October something, you know, 1844. That'll be it. And when that day didn't come, they said, okay, we don't have it quite right. And Brother Miller said, I think very humbly, if you put your faith in Father Miller, you'd be disappointed. But if you have put your faith where we all want to put it, in the divine scripture, then you will have been increased in your understanding. Now, I'm paraphrasing you considerably here. And if we, no matter what experiences we've been through or disappointments as a brotherhood have been through, if we put our trust in the sacred scripture, we will not be disappointed. So Brother Barber was a little disappointed. He went down to Australia. He started being active in other pursuits, mining, so forth. And as I have read the narrative, you know, written by others, I hope it's right, was sailing back from Australia to England to, from there, come back to the United States. You got a lot of time on board a sail ship between those two large areas. So the chaplain on board suggested, why don't we look over the prophecies of Daniel and see what's there? He said, okay, this is a good time for that. So they went through carefully all these prophecies, and it occurred to Brother Barber, maybe Brother Miller's problem was he started the 1290, he backed up 30 years earlier. Maybe he shouldn't have. Maybe all of those prophecies start at the same time, and therefore the 1335 would end 30 years later. 30 years after 1843 would be 1873. That is why you will see, even today, in the volumes, in the reprints, reference to 1873, where you might have expected to see 1872 or 1874. It's because that was the date that a lot of Adventists had in mind. And as Brother Russell said in the early reprints, many of our early readers were actually former Adventists, so that date, 1873, was something they could pick up on. Now, we all know that really he thought 6,000 years ended in 1872 and that the Lord returned 2 years later in 1874. So with that concept, though, about in mind, Brother Barber, when he got to England, he went exactly where I have been two or three times myself, the British Library in London, in England. You know, I had to stop over in England a couple of times, and, you know, I had either a day, you know, or some hours, and I know the subways in London now. I got them down, you know. So I was able to get my ticket, buy a pass for 2 days, go where I wanted, and I know how to get to the British Library. Been there about probably three times. And that's what, he didn't ride the subway, but he got to the British Library. He found some books there. He's looking now. He's looking for a way to get 6,000 years to end in 1873, about that. He found a way that almost was right. It was a few years off. I think it was about 10 years off, but according to some accounts, only 2 years off. And so he found, he said, this must be about right. He made a few adjustments, and that's what we have. That's what we know as the Bowen chronology, and that's why Brother Barber selected that chronology, not because he went through all the details and says this is the only way it can be. If you understand the history of why he selected that, there were a variety of options he found. He chose it because it fit everything else that made sense. That's not an unreasonable way to approach a subject, but then you better backfill the evidence and really find out. Jeff, go ahead.
I don't know if there's a microphone or not, but
no,
you're pretty close. There's the book that he found, Hori Apocalyptica, actually had 1872 as the ending of the 6,000 years. And it's identical to what Brother Russell used in the second one. But what Hori Apocalyptica was doing was it was modifying an earlier chronology from the 1820s by Henry Fiennes Clinton. That ended in 1862.
Okay. I got to talk to you more about that, because the more I research I did on that, I saw the conclusion, 1872, but I could never find the underpinning evidence to point to that. So I'll have to dialogue with you more on that. Okay. So that, but he picked up the chronology that made sense. I think I would have done the same, you know, but now we backfilled. But now Brother Russell comes to this issue. He says, okay, 6,000 years ended in 1874, but the 1,000 years doesn't begin until the church is complete. And even then, not at least until 1914, because maybe the church would be complete before that, but no, we have to wait to the Gentile times to end before you can begin the kingdom of Christ. So we went in, and then a little bit later, just a few years later, I think it's reprint 3450 or thereabouts. Don't quote me on that one. Quote me on 2739. That I know. There's another article in the reprints, and it's almost as though he's found an answer to his dilemma. And he presents two charts. One that shows, you know, 2,500 years in these big arcs, ending in 1874, and the other shows 2,520 years here, that would end in 1914. I can almost read between the lines a little sigh of relief. This is the point. So 1914 will be the beginning of the 1,000 years, and that symmetry kind of shows it, and the chronology comes out essentially right. And, you know, that's the clarity. Everything will end in 1914. Sounds pretty good, but it didn't happen. It just didn't happen. That solution was not correct. Go ahead.
I say, Brother John Entwistle's chart has the 1,000 years beginning in 1914.
Okay, this was probably a derivative of that thing that appeared in the reprints, and it was actually a chart drawn by somebody else other than Brother Russell, but he thought, boy, this looks good. Yeah. Okay. So now here we are. So what do we do with this? Well, it just didn't work. That's the fact. It just didn't work. So we're back to the issue of we don't really understand. There's something missing here. Maybe someday it'll be known. Now, I propose that it's unknowable. It was unknowable when Brother Russell died. It was unknowable for a long time. Now, I'm going to give you the quickest, simplest version of 6,000 years maybe you've ever heard. Who has the NIV here today? Who uses the NIV regularly? I don't want you to look it up. There's a reason for that. I want a hard Bible. You got a Bible here anywhere that has it printed? Because I need a footnote. I need a footnote. That's why I'm saying that. NIV, 1 Kings 6:1, famous text, often disputed, but I'm not going to go to the disputation here. I just want to see what 1 Kings 6:1 says in the NIV note. But let's read 1 Kings 6:1. I am surprised in a group of brethren. I never use the NIV, but almost everybody seems to, you know, but nobody here. Okay, well, then anybody read 1 Kings. Oh, Dave, you got it.
Well, I've got the footnotes in.
Okay, good. Well, you keep it, and you read the footnotes when I need it. But for somebody, read 1 Kings 6:1 out of any version you've got.
Yeah. What was the scripture?
1 Kings 6, verse 1. You're a good reader. It's worth waiting for.
1 Kings what now?
6, verse 1.
Came to pass in the 480th year after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the fourth year of Solomon's reign over Israel, in the month Ziv, which is the second month, that he began to build the house of the Lord.
Okay, the building of the house of the Lord is the issue. And the point is that today we have a date for the building of the house of the Lord, for the foundation of Solomon's temple, that today is widely accepted in the scholarly world, among those who actually believe the Bible is sensible. Now, there's a lot of people that don't really value the Bible testimony. You all know that. But if you go to scholars who believe the Bible is credible, sensible, and an accurate guide, that would describe all of us, then there is a very wide consensus on 966 BC for the date of the founding of Solomon's temple. Brother Dave, do you see a footnote that refers to that at 1 Kings 6:1?
The footnote that has your Hebrew Septuagint, 440th.
Okay, now it's talking about this disputed time period, but isn't there another note about the...
I do not
okay,
have it.
Okay. If you look at an NIV study Bible and you look at the bottom at the footnotes on it, it'll tell you this year is 966 BC. Now, rarely does the Bible in any version put dates in it. Sometimes they do, but this is they venture to put this in because it was a very widely accepted date. Now, I'm not one to take a widely accepted date and run with it. I'm one to say, okay, what's the proof to me that widely accepted date is right? I've spent years on this point. It's gone back some years, but I've got it all. I've explained, this comes from the work of a brother, Edwin Thiel. I'll call him a brother. He was a Seventh-day Adventist. He was a very religious and devoted man. I think it's fair to call him a brother. Edwin Thiel, who wrote in the 1940s and 1950s, and my edition of his book is in the 1960s. Nobody cracked this code of what date was Solomon's temple until Edwin Thiel. Now, okay, there was one exception. There was a gentleman whose name right now escapes me. It's in Edwin Thiel's footnote. He didn't even know about it till he finished his studies. And it's a gentleman in something like Holland or someplace like that. And he had published, you know, a few years earlier than Edwin Thiel. But 966 BC is widely accepted. I venture to say it's conclusive, that it's really very, very supported. You can support it with four strands of evidence, but I'm not going to talk about that. I'm just going to say this. Suppose for a minute that this is correct. You know how Brother Russell started in Volume 2? He said, we'll take a widely accepted date and we'll append the history of the Old Testament to that. Let's use the same method. Let's take this widely accepted date and let's simply append the history of the Old Testament to it, straightforward, right from the Hebrew Old Testament. The date you're going to get is 3927 BC, 3928. Oh my goodness, could I possibly forget that date at this point? Let's see. 58. You could ask me at any moment of the day. I'd know that date, but up here in front of you, it's 3958. So what does that mean? Well, this is what it means. Before I tell you anything else, before I tell you the date, if you all know the date anyway, where I'm going, I just want to give you this point. With this thought in mind, what does this do to things relevant to Brother Russell? Well, with this lineup of chronological dates in mind, that means that 6,000 years would end future from our time right now. So what would that do? If that's correct, then it would resolve the issue that Brother Russell could not resolve. How it is that 6,000 years would end somewhere around here, and yet the 1,000 years would be future from that point of view when the church is complete. We have never, ever had a resolution of that opinion, of that concern, of that very definitely stated problem upon which Brother Russell says, we don't know how to answer this, and we haven't been informed, and maybe it won't be for some time, 2739. So now we have a resolution. This would be sometime in the future. Now, I won't even say the date there, just that it would be in the future, and it's about a generation from today. But if that's true, then look what happens. We can put in this 2,500-year period here the 40 years of the prophecy of Jeremiah. Now, Brother Tom, there you are up there. You've given a talk, am I right, about the man with the writer's inkhorn and thought that it had some connection to Jeremiah in the time it was written. Got your thought right? Okay. I find that very appealing. I think it's correct. And you can identify that Jeremiah's period of service was 40 years up until the time when the city was taken and the sanctuary was destroyed. It was 40 years exactly. Now, he didn't die then, but that was the end of his ministry leading up to that judgment, that final judgment. 40 years. Now, let's take the same period of time over here, and it's, 2,500 years later. It would be, okay, I have to, that's right, I'm okay. Yeah. That would be sometime in the future. And it turns out that the corresponding 40 years here would be exactly from 1874 to 1914. Those are the 40 years after the Lord's return in which the seventh messenger did his work until the time of the time of judgment. Now, it's not when he died, just like this isn't when Jeremiah died. We actually don't know when Jeremiah died exactly. We know when Brother Russell did. But these are the 40 years of his active service until the time of judgment. Now, how is it that just taking that widely accepted date, 966 BC, appending without debate the history of the Old Testament from that point forward, backward to Adam, that suddenly, by that method, suddenly the testimony of Brother Russell and his service as the seventh messenger immediately pops out as a correspondency to the work of Jeremiah? Now, if you don't think that the man clothed with the writer's inkhorn was Pastor Russell, it's okay. You still see that 40-year parallel. But if you do accept that widely held view among the brethren, and I do as well, then I see that the person who fulfilled that prophecy here and the person that fulfilled that prophecy here stand out in stark contrast and relief to each other, both exactly 2,500 years apart. How did this happen? If we're wrong in this widely accepted date and appending the history of the Hebrew Old Testament. Now, that's not a proof that we're on the right track, but it's a stunning consequence of the fact that we think we are. This very conclusion highlights the ministry of Pastor Russell in a way that you have never seen it highlighted mathematically, as it were, before. So I think the very fact that this answers the question that Brother Russell proposed as something he couldn't yet resolve, and now, decades after he passed, we can resolve, it just all makes sense. But let's see now. Now we're going to go forward in this booklet, and we're going to have it from the standpoint of Israel. Now, I could say a lot of these things that were going to be said from the standpoint of the church and the new creation and all of our... I'm not going to do that. This booklet is about Israel. So this is going to be with respect to Israel. So we're going to We're going to go to some prophecies about Israel. Here's a whole bunch of them. And maybe we'll have these read by you, if you can. And I don't care about the translation, but if I'm going to just go around and assign these, we can read them quick. You'll know these scriptures. They will sound familiar. It's all about the hopes of Israel. Richard, could we start with you? Is that okay? Or you don't have the Bible right in front of you. That's okay. Helen, we'll start with you. Isaiah 2, 2 and 3. Look that up. Esther, could you get Isaiah 2, 4 and 5? Jeff, I wasn't sure if you're on track. You're okay. Isaiah 49, 3 and 6. Adrian, Jeremiah 3, 17. Let's see who's back there. Josie, would you get Daniel 12, 1 and 2? And then in this Joel passage, let's see, I think we're going to reduce that a little bit. Let's see, who's that sister next to you?
Irene,
thank you. Sister Irene, are you able to get a scripture for us?
I don't have my Bible.
Oh, okay. Then Sister Lee, can you get for us, let's see. This would be Joel 2, verse, just 27, Lee, just verse 27. And then, let's see, who do we have here? Sebastian, the father of Sebastian. Chris, thank you. I'm sorry, but he was a beautiful singer. See, I know who you are. Okay, Chris, would you please get for us, that would be Amos 9, but just verses 14 and 15. That would be fine. See, I guess I'm going across here. What am I doing? I don't know. But get for us Amos 9, 14 and 15. Well, no, I'm sorry. I'm going in the wrong direction. Please get Micah 4 and get just verse 2, just verse 2, if you would. And Christy, would you get for us Zephaniah 3, 8 and 9? No, I'm sorry. I'm going out of the booklet. I'm going the wrong order. Get for us Haggai 2, and that would be... No, we're going to skip that one, I'm afraid. Zechariah 14. No, that's Malachi. Just get Malachi 3:18. Sorry to be a little off key here. Brother David, would you get for us Ezekiel 39? And we're just going to read verses 28 and 29, David, on those, not the full passage. And let's see, Brother Jim, could you get for us Hosea 14? See, Hosea, yeah, 4 through 6, that would be fine. And then, Brother Dan, could you get for us Zephaniah 3, 8, and 9? And Sister Donna, could you get for us Zechariah 14, 8, and 9? We're going to skip the last one. Okay, now you know what you're supposed to read. You see how confused I was, so I'll just call you to read your scriptures. Sister Helen.
This is Isaiah 2, 2 and 3.
Yeah.
And it shall come to pass in the last days that the mountain of the Lord's house shall be established in the top of the mountains, and shall be exalted above the hills, and all nations shall flow unto it. And many people shall go and say, Come ye, and let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us of his ways, and we will walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem.
Okay, very famous text for us. But Jews reading this should know this is really going to happen. And this is really fundamental to their hopes. Isaiah 2, 4, and 5.
And he will judge between the nations. And he will render decisions for many peoples. And they will hammer their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not lift up sword against nation. And never again will they learn war. Come, house of Jacob, and let us walk in the light of the Lord.
You know, this is such a famous text, they even have it on the United Nations. Is that right? Beat their swords into plowshares? It's right there out of Isaiah. How is this, when, how, does anybody wonder out there as they pass by that and read that scripture? When, how, really, is this real? Is this just a dream? Oh, it's a promise from God. It's going to happen in real time. All the weapons gone. Oh, remarkable. And this is going to be the God of Israel that's going to accomplish this. Isaiah 49, 3 and 6.
And he said to me, You are my servant, Israel, in whom I will be glorified. In verse 6 it says, He says, It is too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to bring back the preserved of Israel. I will make you as a light for the nations, that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth.
Okay, thank you. That was Jeremiah?
Isaiah 49.
Oh, I'm sorry, 49 and 3. Thank you very much. Next, Jeremiah 3:17.
At that time they shall call Jerusalem the throne of the Lord, and all the nations shall be gathered unto it, to the name of the Lord, to Jerusalem. Neither shall they walk any more after the imagination of their evil heart.
Thank you. And Daniel 12:1-2.
And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, which standeth for the children of thine people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be found written in the book.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
Did I skip a line?
No, I don't know. I'm not reading it. But are you done?
No.
Finish.
And many of them that sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, and some to everlasting life, and some to shame and everlasting contempt.
Okay. Now, Michael was, known as kind of the patron angel for Israel. Michael stands for the children of thy people. And Michael, of course, we know as our Lord Jesus, but the Jews would know him as a patron angel for their own sake. At some time, this is going to come when Israel is going to be delivered by this great Michael. Joel 2, and what was that? Joel 2:27.
Thus you will know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I am the Lord your God, and there is no other, and my people will never be put to shame.
Okay. Amos 9:14-15. No, I'm sorry. This order is different than this. Micah 4, and what was that? Verse 2.
And many nations shall come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, that he may teach us his ways, and that we may walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem.
Okay, now Micah was a contemporary of Isaiah. That's why these words are so close to the one we had read earlier in Isaiah. They're parallel passages, and they're a double expression of this prophecy. We're going to skip the Haggai and go to Malachi 3:18.
So you will again distinguish between the righteous and the wicked, between one who serves God and one who does not serve him.
Was that 3:18?
Yes.
Okay, so I guess that the point there is in Israel, they're going to be purged and purified, and they'll know that only the good are going to be testifying then. This would be Ezekiel, next one is Ezekiel 39. And
48 and 49.
Okay, thank you.
And they shall know that I am Jehovah their God, in that I caused them to go into captivity among the nations, and have gathered them unto their own land. And I will leave none of them any more there, neither will I hide my face any more from them. For I have poured out my spirit upon the house of Israel, saith the Lord Jehovah.
Now these texts are just so clear that it's literally Israel involved. There's really, you can't spiritualize all this. This is very fundamental, and I think there's many Israelites, but according to the flesh, that treasure these promises, but not enough, and not as many as there will be. Hosea 14:4-6.
I will heal their backsliding. I will love them freely, for mine anger is turned away from him. I will be as the dew unto Israel. He shall grow as the lily, and cast forth his roots as Lebanon. His branches shall spread, and his beauty shall be as the olive tree, and his smell as Lebanon.
Thank you. And Amos 9:14-15.
You actually gave me Zephaniah?
I did.
Yeah.
Then read what I gave you.
Okay. Therefore wait ye upon me, saith the Lord, until the day that I rise up to the prey, for my determination is to gather the nations, that I may assemble the kingdoms, to pour upon them my indignation, even all my fierce anger, for the earth shall be devoured with the fire of my jealousy. And then verse 9, for then I will turn to the people a pure language, and if they may call upon the name of the Lord, to serve him with one consent.
Thank you. To whom did I give Zechariah 14:14 and 15, Donna?
Yeah, 14:8 and 9 you gave me.
Okay, read those two.
And it shall be in that day that living water shall go out from Jerusalem, half of them toward the former sea, and half of them toward the hinder sea. In summer and in winter shall it be. And the Lord shall be king over all the earth. In that day shall there be one Lord, and his name one.
Excellent. Thank you. And did I give anybody Amos 9:14 and 15? Okay, that's another good scripture. You do. Go ahead.
Amos 9.
Yes.
14 through 15. And I will bring back the captivity of my people Israel, and they shall build the waste cities and inhabit them, and they shall plant vineyards and drink the wine thereof, and they shall make gardens and eat the fruit of them. And I will plant them upon their land, and they shall no more be plucked up out of their land which I have given them, saith Jehovah thy God.
Okay, now all these scriptures are precious to us. We know all of those scriptures. They're nothing new here. We just kind of list them here for the Jewish people. And, you know, I think when you go through these scriptures, they're so emphatic about the hope for Israel that when you go back to the 1800s, and there was a series of prophetic studies in England, Brother Henry Drummond, I think, was a person that congealed a lot of these. If I get the name wrong, Jeff, you let me know. Drummond?
Drummond was more involved with the two-stage coming, the coming for the saints and the coming.
Okay, but was he that had these people, you know, at his estate, you know, repeatedly?
Albury Park Common.
Yeah, Albury, yeah. And they came to, at the end, to 6 points of agreement when they summed up these studies that went on for some years, every quarter. Had a lot of, you know, cogent, good-thinking people. And one of them was, God is going to bring his natural people back to the Holy Land and reestablish them. These texts are so clear and so dynamic that whether you are in a little fog about other things or not, these are clear. Another one of their points was that he is going to redeem even the brute creation. By brute, he didn't mean the unthinking, the unknowing creation. He didn't mean the animals. He meant those that are even unaware of the good things. Well, it sounds a whole lot like what we expect. This is the kingdom coming to everyone in the world, whether they expect it or not. Brother Jeff.
Out of those conferences was another guy named Alexander Dallas. Alexander Dallas suggested that not only if Israel is going to be saved, unbelieving Israel, that perhaps even the unbelieving world.
There you go.
And then another gentleman beyond that took Dallas' writings and said, well, if the unbelieving world is going to be saved, then there's going to be two salvations. And Henry Dunn got that idea, George Storrs and Brother Russell.
There you go.
So direct links.
Nice connection between those old studies. Very good. Okay, we're going to move on. And we have this next in the booklet. Now, all these slides are going to be things you will find in the booklet. So it's nothing different than what you're going to find there. This is kind of a review of what we present here in writing. 70 years between Petah Tikva in 1878 and independence in 1948. Now, that's an engaging point because you know that when they lost their independence, Jeremiah the prophet said it's going to be in a period of 70 years. Jeremiah 29:10 says Babylon would have control for 70 years. Jeremiah 25th chapter, verses 11 and 12, thereabouts, he talks about 70 years in which Babylon is going to subdue all these nations of the Middle East. Now, if you look at the whole list of all of those nations, you'll find among them Tyre. But you find in the book of Ezekiel that Tyre was not subjugated until more than a decade after Jerusalem fell to Zedekiah and the temple was to Nebuchadnezzar and the temple was burned. So all of these nations would fall during the 70 years. They would not all be subsumed for an entire 70 years. And that's a key ingredient to the understanding of the 70 years. This is a portion for Babylon during which not only Israel, but all these other nations would be subdued. Now, that is such a famous period in the Jewish mind that it comes to a connection in the Jewish mind when Israel was reestablished in 1948, when they asked David Ben-Gurion, when did this process of restoration commence? And he said, 1878, with the first settlement of Petah Tikva. Now, the background to this really starts a little earlier with the election of the only Jewish prime minister that England has ever had. Now, who is that man? Disraeli, Benjamin Disraeli, and Lord Beaconsfield, Benjamin Disraeli, yeah. And he was elected, actually, in 1874. We focus on 1878 so much that we forget that little point. And by the way, just for your interest, there is a book, and this is not in the booklet, but in doing research for this booklet, I did find there was a book titled 1874 to 1914. Who would ever write a book like that but us? You know? But somebody else did, and they were marking it from the appointment of Benjamin Disraeli until the time of trouble in 1914, and they saw a connection building in all of these events. So a completely involved with Bible students observer, I think he was even an unreligious person, just historically, sees that 40 years as a remarkable period of time. And of course, we do too, for different reasons, and some of the same reasons. So, but 1878, the first Jewish colony reestablished. Now, I have heard, I think my father brought this to my attention, that that first colony may not have endured, and they may have had to come back and reestablish it later. Whatever the circumstances were, that was the first colony that was established after the Ottoman power yielded to Benjamin Disraeli at the Berlin Congress of Nations to give equal treatment of the law to all of the citizens of the Ottoman Empire. Well, that meant Jews too. Now, I actually found that Berlin Treaty once. I went to the San Diego State University Library, and they've got a copy of this old black book, big, dusty. Nobody's used it for probably 80 years. You know, I pulled it off the shelf, blow the dust off, open it up, it creaks. And there in small print in the back is a whole copy of the Berlin Treaty of Nations. And I scanned it looking for Jews. There's not there. But what it says is equal treatment for all of the citizens of the Ottoman Empire. And that means us too, says the Jews. So they began to buy land in 1878. And they had some rough going for a while. But finally, in 1948, they're a nation again. Is that coincidence? If it's only that, maybe. But, you know, there's more. And I don't think it's a coincidence. I think it's meaningful choice.
Just real quick, Paul and I were in Petatikva a couple of years ago, and right in the center of town, it says, established 1878.
Well, good. I'm glad to know they even have a marker by which they themselves identify that date. Good, good. Thank you. That fortifies, you know, this connection a little bit. I appreciate knowing that. So, 70 years. But, go ahead.
Go on to the next slide.
Okay.
So, you're going backwards here.
I hope not.
Wait.
That's where I was.
Why don't you have the next 70 years on there, 2018, in which Jerusalem now is becoming recognized, and the other major significant thing in 2018 is there are a minimum, probably more, of 12 Arab states that are now recognizing Israel as a legitimate country.
As of what date?
As of 2018.
Did they all start fresh then, or just accumulated?
No, of course, Jordan and Egypt go back to their peace treaty, but Netanyahu, just last month, I think it was at a conference in Poland, in Warsaw, Poland, that he was the only head of state there, with 12 ambassadors or whatever, the top heads of state, but not the top, of 12 Arab countries, along with another 50 other countries. And their discussion was peace in the Middle East, how to have peace in the Middle East. But the fact is, he ate for the first time with these. He had conferences with these Arabs, and it's a different ballgame today than it was in 1948 when all those nations surrounded and wanted to invade.
Very different, very different. Now, you mentioned that 2018 is when the United States officially recognized Jerusalem. Now, that was really like late in 2017, but past Tishri, and therefore falls into the year you could numerate as 2018. Am I got your point right?
Yes.
Yeah, and this was President Trump. And, you know, he had said, one of his campaign promises when he ran was, I'm going to recognize the state of Israel. But he's not the only one that said that. Other presidents before him have said it and reneged. But President Trump, whatever his failings are, we're all human, and he's got public failings, you know, But this he has. There's a certain thread of honesty that runs back of him that kind of reminds me of another potentate years ago. His name was Nebuchadnezzar. I don't think I'd want him as president, Nebuchadnezzar. But he did have a certain thread of honesty and integrity in him, so much so that if these wise men can't understand his dream and they claim to do that, then away with them. You know? I mean, there's a certain thread of justice there. It's pretty severe justice, you know. But with Trump, he said, I promised it, I've got to do it. You know, he didn't do it the first opportunity. He didn't. All his advisors, of course, advised the same thing he'd been advising for 20 years. Put it off, it's going to be trouble. Second time came around, he says, look, I promised it, I'm going to do it. And so he went ahead. Say, Dan, sorry.
Well, part of this, too, is that I think there is a 70-year parallel because Truman in 48, he had one advisor, Clark Clifford. Every other advisor told him, do not recognize a new Jewish state. And he went out and lived and did it. And I think what happened in 2018, the U.S. was the first to recognize Jerusalem as they were the first to recognize Israel. And now, slowly, other nations are following suit and recognizing Jerusalem.
Yeah, wonderful.
So I think he's there at the right time for the right purpose. That's my opinion. Now, you know, his daughter is Ivanka. What faith is she?
Jewish.
Converted Jewish because her husband, Jared Kushner, is Jewish. And I just heard recently somebody tell me about, you know, he just recognized the Golan Heights as an acquisition of Israel. And why did he do that? Somebody, who was I driving? Who told me that? Somebody told me that. Oh, was that? Yeah, Adrian. Tell us about that, Adrian, just very briefly.
I guess he had a conversation with the ambassador to Israel and with Jared Kushner. He said, give me the short version, because I like short versions. And he pretty much explained it to him, the story about Golan Heights. And I guess in a half an hour, he later said, I'm going to recognize Golan Heights. And that was about it.
There you go. Decided, and that's what he's going to do. You know, I know, you know, when we think about our Christian faith, it's deep. Others, you know, maybe it's not as deep. But I'll tell you, I do remember when he gave his acceptance, you know, for it. He talked about something spiritual. And I remember when his wife, what's her name, Melania, she got up to speak a little bit. What did she recite? The Lord's Prayer. I've never heard another First Lady ever venture to say something so politically incorrect as the Lord's Prayer. Now, she stumbled a little bit. People derided her a little bit, but I didn't. I was just glad to hear those words. So, God knows what he's doing. God knows what he's doing. You know, I when the Clintons were in power, you know, a long time ago, I just observed, whatever you think politically, that I observed that he was kind of pro-Israel, at least during his administration. And now I see Trump very pro-Israel. I thought Reagan was very pro-Israel, but I don't think anybody is as much as the president. So he's got his role to play, and he's on the scene at the right time for the right point. Okay, we'll go a little further. These are the dates, specific dates, that are interesting in the reestablishment of Israel. 1874 with President Benjamin Disraeli. 1878, the first Jewish colony. 1896, the Jewish state was published by Theodore Herzl. And 1904 is actually the date when Herzl passed away. You know how old he was when he died?
Young.
44. 44. The older I get, the younger that is. That's 44. I was surprised at that. But, you know, when the importance of Herzl. Now, we emphasize him a lot. You know, Brother Ken Rossin, you talked about him in his presentations. But you wonder, okay, are we drawing more than they do? But no. You look in the book. Maybe I've got it here coming up. I don't really remember. But in this booklet on page 8, look at that book. See that picture on page 8, black and white picture? That's a picture of the time when Israel was being formally declared to be a state, independent. You see a picture hanging at the front of the auditorium? Whose picture is that, Hannah? Herzl, that's right. He'd long since dead. He died in 1904, but they still recognized him. His name actually appears in the Jewish Declaration, either Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, whatever it is. His name is there as kind of a founding father. So when we highlight the date of his Jewish state, that was really a milestone, and Israel recognizes his influence to this day. 1904, what really happened is Herzl died, but Herzl had actually entertained the possibility, because of practical expediency, of maybe finding the Jewish state somewhere other than the land of Israel. Now, to us, that would be, you know, anathema. But in those days, you didn't know what was going to work. You looked at options. But when he died in 1904, they refocused on the land of Israel. And 1914, World War I, Balfour Declaration. World War I is meaningful because, you know, the Ottoman Empire was a protege, kind of England. And everybody was kind of surprised they didn't join England on that side of the war. They chose the other side. And so that meant that England now was going to be at war with the Ottoman Empire. And so they went to invade, they took it over, and as a consequence, in 1917, they said, Her Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national homeland for the Jewish people. And they finally, after some decades, that did materialize, 1948 statehood restored. Jeff.
In 1917, when General Allenby captured Jerusalem, it actually started a few months before that. He was promoted to general in June, and one of his under generals called him up and said, I think you're going to capture Jerusalem before the end of the year. And his question was, well, why? But he was told about Henry Grattan Guinness's books, Approaching the End of the Age and Life of the Last Days, where he suggested both 1914 and 1917 as the end of the Ottoman Empire and the beginning of the nation of Israel returning back to their land. Guinness died in 1909, so we never knew what happened. But in his Bible, between Daniel and Ezekiel, was another date written, 1948, question mark.
Oh.
But this chronology that Guinness used was the same one from Hori Apocalypticae that we spoke about earlier, which is the same one that Barber used in Brother Russell.
Interesting. So 1917 was a date which was actually a published date earlier. Very engaging. So historically, these are dates that are fundamental to the reestablishment of Israel, just as historical observations. Now, when we go a little farther than this, we're going to talk about the 1,000 years. Now, you all know that the 1,000 years is meaningful. We have to kind of establish that for a new reader in the booklet. But, you know, Psalms 90, verse 4 talks about 1,000 years are in thy sight as yesterday when it is past. That's really where we get the thought of a 1,000-year day from. And the Jewish Encyclopedia, you'll see a note there, Jewish Encyclopedia on page 3 at the bottom. Can somebody read that footnote about the Jewish Encyclopedia? It's very brief. What does it say in bottom of page 3?
Notice something similar in the Jewish Encyclopedia. 7,000 years, the 7,000th year being the millennium, the great Sabbath of the Lord. 1906 edition, sabbatical year, and jubilee.
Okay, now I look for a lot more. There's not much on it, but there is at least that on it, that the Jewish hope of a seventh millennium being something special in the history of the world was part of their consideration. Ezekiel 46:1, we'll get to that in just a moment. Book of Jubilee, I'm sorry, Book of Jubilees, note number 2. Now that's, thank you. Page 5, isn't it? Is that right, at the footnote on page 5?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jeff. What do you
think? Book of Jubilees is an apocryphal book reflecting Jewish thought in the late centuries preceding the Common Era.
Okay, so what do the Jubilees say? Here's what it says. When Adam died at 930, he lacked 70 years of 1,000, for 1,000 years are as one day in the testimony of the heavens. Book of Jubilees. So that explains how the Jewish mind was thinking of things in those days. That was, you know, about the AD era. So for a Jewish mind, this should be notable that 1,000 years is actually meaningful, and especially the 7,000 years. Now we get to Ezekiel 46:1. Now we mentioned this yesterday briefly. We didn't comment too much on it, except that it has the concept of 6 days and of one day. Let's read it one more time, Ezekiel 46:1. And with special notice about the days that are involved. Who can flip to that quickly for us? Yes, would you
want an NIV or do you want to...
Whatever you got, that's okay.
NIV up right now. Okay, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. The gate of the inner court facing east is to be shut on the 6 working days, but on the Sabbath day and on the day of the new moon, it is to be opened.
Okay. Now, yesterday we didn't make the emphasis, but today we will. We often ask brethren when we talk about this subject, today... For the world of mankind, not for you and me and other people that are aspiring to the high calling, but for the world of mankind, are those gates closed or open for them to access the Heavenly Father? Jim, what would you say? They're closed. So if that's correct, then which of these days are we on, the 6 or the last one? Are we on the 6 days when it's closed, or on the seventh day when it's open?
Closed, on the seventh day it's open.
That's right. So we'd still be on the days when it's closed. And the point of that is, that testimony, Ezekiel 46:1, tells us that we haven't come to this point yet of the end of 6,000 years. It doesn't tell us when it will be. But that text, if we see that those gates are closed today, then we must be still on the 6 days, not the seventh day, when those gates would be wide open. Now, maybe you say, yeah, but this is approximate. Okay, that's fine. But if you just had this text to go by, I think that would be consistent. But Ezekiel 46, verse 1 does tell us that one day out of the seven, the Sabbath day, is meaningful to the time of blessing for the world. And it would be consistent to make that a thousand-year day with these other texts. And now we go a little further. There's the 7,000 years. We got the same thing over there, but 1,000 years for Adam, 1,000 years for the restoration, and two periods of 2,500 years. Now, the point of bringing this out for the Jewish audience is we're going to try to tell them that 6,000 years have not yet ended, but it's approaching, and therefore things are going to wrap up well for them. Now, we'll take that same chart of 1,000, 2,500, 2,500, and 1,000. We don't have any dates there for the end of 6,000 years, so this is immaterial. As long as you have a concept that 6,000 years are somewhere in the future, not in the past. That is, if you go by Solomon's Temple about 966, add the history of the Hebrew Old Testament, it's in the future. If that's true, this stands out in stark relief. That is, in 553 BC, that's where the prophecy of Daniel chapter 7 was given to Daniel. Now you'll see it says, what, in the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, I, Daniel, had this vision. Now the book of Daniel, you know how many chapters it has? 12, that's right. And you divide it in six and six. The first six are historical. The second six are prophetic. You say, oh, wait a minute, there's prophecies in the first, yeah, but not that Daniel had. There's dreams by Nebuchadnezzar, things like that. But the second set of six is all Daniel's visions. And they begin right there at 553 BC, the first year of Belshazzar. Now, how do we know that date? Well, we know because the last king of Babylon, that really was the emperor of Babylon, the overall ruler, was a person named Nabonidus. And this was a critique about the book of Daniel for a long time. It says the last king was a man named Belshazzar, but all history knows him as Nabonidus. And this was one of the reasons that some people impugned the integrity of the book of Daniel. It wasn't written by somebody who knew what was going on. And then later they found out, oh, well, how about that? Nabonidus had a son named Belshazzar, and he appointed him to the kingship in his third year because he was an aged monarch and wanted to have other enterprises. So now we know the date, 553 BC. That's the date when Daniel got his vision about these four world empires that are going to dominate and overturn the independence of Israel. You put that date on the map here, the corresponding date over here, exactly 1948. This is not a random date. It's not a random date for Daniel's vision. These dates are put in there because they have meaning and they have purpose. And here's the purpose. Exactly in symmetry 2,500 years later, the reestablishment of the independence of the state of Israel that was in vision shown to be overthrown by the four world governments in 553 BC. Go a little further. There's all the dates that we had in focus from 1874, Benjamin Disraeli, 1878, 1896, the Jewish state, 1904, a refocus on Israel, 1914, the beginning of World War I. All of those have an exact parallel. In this corresponding period, Jeremiah began his service. There's the Jubilee Reformation in harmony with Petatikva's reestablishment. The first captivity happened in 605, corresponding to the publication of his book. The second captivity in 597, exactly in parallel here, and the final captivity of Jerusalem, 587, in parallel to 1914. So all of the dates that we showed you earlier, 1874, 78, 96, 04, 14, all of those dates that stand on their own on their own substance as meaningful, important dates in the history of the reconstruction of the nation of Israel, every single one of those has a parallel event in the demise of Israel 2,500 years earlier. Now, maybe you got the number 2520 in your mind. That's okay. We'll get to that. But this symmetry, this parallelism, this meaning, it just pops out when you use what today is recognized as the absolute dates of history in this period of time. All of these things spontaneously punch out. It's a testimony that the reestablishment of Israel in the stages that they've gone through is not random. These are timed to show you that the Master of the heavens is operating according to some plan and some fixed rules of engagement. He's bringing Israel back in accord with prophetic time exactly right. I think, to me, it's compelling. Now, maybe you look at a chart like this and you say, I don't know, I got to wade through the meaning of these, wade through it then. If you find anything you think is missing, superfluous, or forced, let me be the first to know. Email, you know, it's great. This is stunning. To me, it is stunning. None of these dates have anything to do with an invention by me. These are dates that are commonly received publicly, scholarly dates, published dates. These are historical things we observe in our period of history. There's nothing forced here, nothing changed, nothing bent, curved. These are just parallels that exist. Now, do you see this 40 years here? That's the 40 years of Jeremiah's service that we talked about earlier. These 40 years, now I didn't talk about this in this booklet for the Jews, you see, but for us Christians, especially people that know the significance of the seventh messenger, that pops out. The person that gave all of these prophecies and warned natural Israel here is warning spiritual Israel here. The corresponding prophet, that's our Pastor Russell. So this does not diminish the impact or the force or the testimony for Brother Russell. It augments it. It increases it. Of course, there are some minor changes in the count of years. I recognize that. But once you make those minor count of years change, then all of a sudden everything is answered. All of the things he couldn't answer now have a resolution. The things that he affirmed are affirmed correctly, and that is the 1,000 years begins after the jewels are complete, still another generation ahead of us. Everything just makes sense. And for Israel, we even without a Christian perspective, they should be able to see this. So I hope they do when they whoever reads this book. Now, we're going into time prophecies that you're all familiar with. I don't remember ever hearing a Jewish scholar or prophetic thinker talk about the 1260 or the 1335 years. I wouldn't be surprised if some rabbi somewhere has considered this, but I don't. Jim, you ever hear anything about this? Jeff, any rabbinical teaching? Okay, so we're introducing this to the Jewish community, and it's just what you've always known and learned before. The time prophecies from 539 Justinian take you to Napoleon, and that's the time of papacy. Now, I used to sometimes lead Bible studies at a jail. My father started doing that, and he had to go visit brethren in Australia, so they rubber-stamped me through the process so I could substitute for him. And after that, we kept going. We did this until they closed the jail down for the men's facility. And there was a lot of Catholics in jail, you know? I mean, there would be, right? Catholics are a lot of people, so a lot of people are going to be there from... So I'm not saying they're bad, Catholics are worse than anybody else, okay? You might reason yes or no. But, I mean, the population statistics means there's going to be some Catholics there. So I like numbers, I like prophecy. I'm going to talk about the 1260 years somewhere, right? I'm going to do it. And so I did. And, you know, I never had a public concern from any of them that were Catholic. I merely presented as a matter of history that from the fall of the Roman Empire, what was the dominant force of the European powers for over 1,200 years? And anybody can see that's the Roman Catholic Church. It's just a matter of factual history. Now, I have a book on my shelf that takes me through the history of all of the popes. I haven't read the whole thing. I check it, for things I'm interested in. And they start a brand new chapter in that book in 1799, because that's when the Pope that was a prisoner of Napoleon died as a prisoner, and he would not allow the election of a successor. He says this starts a new chapter in the history of papacy. So it's not that difficult to show these 1260 years really are a historic fulfillment of the Jewish prophet in public testimony that we can all appreciate, even Jewish people. They can see that. But the 1335 years is going to take us finally to the last thing that Daniel talks about, and that is Daniel chapter 12, when Michael is going to stand up. And he gives you the time prophecy to connect to that at the end of that chapter. 1335 days. So 1874, we would say the return of our Lord and the parousia and the beginning of the harvest. Exactly. But for the Jewish audience, that's when Michael stands up that stands for the children of thy people, Israel. And in 1874, we've already laid the groundwork. That was the election of Benjamin Disraeli, who later influenced the Berlin Congress. Oh, it just all fits. So without Jesus, without anything, the Jewish audience should be able to see, okay, there's meaning here for us. Seven times. Well, we talk about that too. We talk about the time prophecies in the booklet. I don't have to say too much about that because you all know what a prophetic time is. It's 360. Now, how do you handle this in Daniel? How do you prove that a prophetic time is 360? All it says in Daniel is time, times, and half a time, three and a half. You got to go to Revelation, you know, you really do, to understand that that's the same as 42 months, which is 1260 days. So, who wrote Revelation? A Jewish writer. Fortunately. So in the book that we just explained, that as a Jewish writer supplied, you know, his opinion on this later, then, you know, and so you can build the same thought up. But if every prophetic time is 360 years, and you all know that, you know, from our studies of in the scriptures, 607 to 603 was the years of the Babylonian conquest of the Holy Land. 607 BC was the year in which Babylon crossed the river Euphrates for the first time in that period of history, and for 4 years began a campaign of conquest. How do I say that it ended in 603 BC? You'll see that in Daniel, the second chapter. It says, in the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, Nebuchadnezzar came and took prisoner of Daniel and Meshach and Shadrach and Abednego, and took all these people prisoner. And that's because by that time, Nebuchadnezzar had sealed his conquest of the Middle East. It would expand even more. There would be troubles coming. But the scriptures mark that as the end of his conquest of the Middle East. 4 years it took. Go 2,520 years later, 4 years to the breakup of the old powers that were restraining the growth of that tree, Israel. And finally, it could bud again and grow. Now, you all familiar with this, so I'm going to pass by it. But not before emphasizing that only by understanding the proper dates of the Babylonian Empire can you find a four-year Babylonian conquest, a war of conquest here, to parallel exactly 4 years of the release of Israel from that conquest 2,520 years later. The only way you can find a four-year parallel is to find the proper dates for the Babylonian Empire. Okay, 2,520-year parallels. There's a lot of them. And you know what? I'm just going to leave that up there. You can look at it. You can read it in the booklet. But I told you we get to the 2,520-year parallels. There's a lot of them. And there they all are. But I think I'm going to, for time's sake, kind of go through this, flip beyond this. You can read it in the book. It's all there. Everything here is right from the booklet. But there were a whole lot of steps, not just this one, but a whole lot of others, taking you finally to the independence of Israel. And the corresponding date here is Ezekiel 40, verse 1, that we talked about yesterday. The last jubilee of Israel, the final jubilee, and that is 2,520 years before the year in which Israel was released. Now, I've got here 1947 to 48. In 1947 is when the UN agreed that Israel would become independent the next spring, and 1948 is when Israel became independent. But all of these experiences, taking you from the beginning of the Babylonian domain until finally the vision of Ezekiel, all of them have a corresponding history in the experiences that Israel suffered. Yes?
There's one other thing. In the fall of 1947 is when they discovered the complete Isaiah scroll from the Dead Sea.
I didn't remember that.
Yeah, and it's the only, every book of the Old Testament is found there except the book of Ruth, but Isaiah, the Isaiah book, is the only complete one where they have it from start to finish, and they found that in the fall of 47.
Interesting. Okay. I hardly know how to break the news to Ruth. Only one missing, huh? Okay. But 1947, very, very good. Okay, go a little further. Now, you all know the 2300 days take us to the cleansing of the sanctuary and Daniel. But remember, I'm not writing this to you. We're writing this to a Jewish audience. I have long time been of the opinion that the 2300 years, we are correctly applying. Okay, I maybe have a three-year difference or something with Common View, because I think 1843 was the right year. But if you look in Daniel, this is the only time prophecy, perhaps I could say, for which there is no specific starting point given in Daniel, the 8th chapter. But I suggest that there are three possible starting points, and they're all meaningful. One takes you to 1843, one takes you to 1914, and one takes you to 1967. And all of them, I think, are meaningful. You know, when I first heard about this, I first heard about that at a convention in Phoenix when I was, I think, still in my teen years, I'm pretty sure. We just finished the 1967 war. Everybody was intrigued about it. And there was this elderly Greek brother, very humble brother, who's never a speaker. I never thought of him as an elder. He hardly would talk to people. You know, he had a big Greek accent. A humble, short brother. But, you know, I was even younger. Yeah, a real young brother, you know, so he could maybe approach me and talk to me. He told me this. I listened with rapt attention. Just to this young teenager, he divulged his opinion. He was Greek, and this started when Alexander the Greek, the Great, started his campaign way back with the Battle of Granicus, and he knew all about that. And he says, you know, there's 2,300 years from then until Jerusalem was restored in 1967. Now, I'm only presenting this point of view, not all three of them, in this booklet, because this is to the Jewish people. And Alexander the Great interfaced with the Jewish people in remarkable ways. And that's why I think this part of the prophecy, dating from the Jewish, from the Grecian Empire, takes you to a meaningful period in 1967. But don't misunderstand that I'm, you know, discarding the other views that we are precious to us. I don't. I do agree with them. I think that's correct. I just won't talk further about it right now. Okay, 6,000 years, we finally move on to that. Now, I told you earlier that if you take 966 B.C. and you had the history of the Old Testament, you're going to get to 3958 B.C. Go forward 6,000 years, it'll take you to 2043. You all know that's what I think. Everybody knows that's what I think. You know what you think one way or another about it, but you all know my opinion. And I won't discuss these periods very much, except to say that the only point on this screen that is disputed, other than this date, you know, which you're starting with, is this period, 479. Now, maybe you agree with 1 Kings 6:1, maybe you don't. I'd like to reason with you on that, but that's not the point here. The point here is just to explain that if you take the Hebrew Old Testament at face value and use the commonly accepted date today that I have spent years to satisfy myself is precise, you will get this conclusion. And with this conclusion, you find, don't forget, Pastor Elsa's 40 years are in stark contrast to the 40 years of Jeremiah. So it emphasizes his importance. It does not diminish them. And it handles all of the things that he insisted on in the reprints that were not fully disclosed, and yet he knew the 1,000 years of Revelation 20, verse 4, could not begin till the saints were complete. Okay, we'll go a little further, a little farther. This is the whole period that takes you. Finally, I introduce in the booklet the actual dates. Haven't done that before, but I have a point, and that is that if you take 7,000 years with this date, then the midpoint of that time is exactly a period that the Jewish people will recognize as fundamentally important in their restoration after the Babylonian captivity, and that was the restoration occasioned by Ezra. That was in 458 B.C. You'll find the decree of Artaxerxes in the 7th chapter. It takes more than half the chapter to verbatim give the decree that established their return. Now, of course, they had returned already under Cyrus, and they had rebuilt the temple, but they needed now the city to be rebuilt. And if you read that decree authorizes the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the refurbishment of the temple and all the sacrifices. Now, they didn't really finish it because they were delayed until finally Nehemiah came. But this is a very meaningful point in Jewish history, 458, when Ezra returned. And it happens to be right in the middle of the 7,000 years. Now, why is that meaningful to me? Well, okay, I'm not going to debate this point, but just explain. I think that 458 was the beginning of the 70-week prophecy. Now, that would not be meaningful to the Jewish people, right? Because 490 years takes you to Jesus, right? And this isn't the book, you know, we're telling them about that. But you know the prophecy in Habakkuk 3:2? In the midst of the years, in wrath, remember mercy. So in the midst of the 7,000 years, during the time that the wrath of God is still being poured out upon all flesh, right in the midst of the years, he remembers mercy and begins counting the years toward the redemption. And then the first age of redemption. And then the second age of redemption. It all starts right there. Right in the middle, exactly. Now, this feature does depend upon that precise year. And that precise year does depend upon accepting the Hebrew Scriptures at face value. I do, but I haven't only accepted it at face value. Anything disputed here, I've studied in depth. And I'd be happy to interchange with anybody that thinks, well, maybe you've missed something. Oh, I'd be delighted to interchange. But if you just take it at face value, this spontaneously comes. Jeff, did you have a comment?
No.
Okay. So let's move on a little further. Jewish calendar years. I put this in because Paul Agnew said, you better cover this. Okay, it's historically interesting. You said the Jewish year today is, what did you say?
I thought it was 5779.
You know, this is a mistake in this slide. Oh, is it? 2019 Jewish calendar, 5779.
Yeah, 2019 was 5779.
Okay, then whatever it is, we have a 197-year difference with the Jewish calendar. That's made up by one whopping difference of 166 years in the Persian period. The Jews had no good idea of their history, even of the past 500 years, as of the time of Jesus. They didn't even calculate their own history correctly back to the time of Nebuchadnezzar. They were 166 years off. So the Jewish calendar today, okay, it might hold some position in the Jewish mind, but anybody serious, even Jewish, knows it's not right. And so this, we did put a chapter to explain in technical detail the differences. I don't think that's of deep interest to you, but it would be to a Jewish mind.
There are prominent rabbis, Jewish scholars, that are now refuting this 5779 publishing papers on it and challenging that it's a tradition. It's nothing more than a tradition that's held so tenaciously, you know, you wonder why. But I think as younger Jewish Bible seekers are going to investigate this, they're going to come to the truth of it.
Even, you know, I dialogue on the internet with discussion groups that have some Jewish scholars, and they don't really maintain for that calendar. Not really. Joyce?
Well, the Jews used something called the Seder Olam, which was devised by the most famous of all rabbis, Rabbi Akiva, also known as the Rambam. And he deliberately did this so that it would hide the fact of Jesus' first advent.
Yeah, that's right.
Now, they wanted another person that was claiming to be Messiah to be Messiah. But now that's kind of irrelevant to the modern Jewish scholars.
That's right.
And he never says, I'm doing this to hide the fact of Jesus of Nazareth.
Yeah,
so it's a perfect time, I think, to bring it out and show that there is a correspondence you can use the Bible.
Exactly. Thank you, Sister Joyce. Okay, now this is what we've got, is I think the timeline. Now we go forward here to show that there's another testimony to the Jewish mind that in fact this is on track. And that is, since the first date we used in the booklet for the end of the period of when God is kind of stepping forward on behalf of Israel, the election of Disraeli in 1874, it was 74 days to 1948, and after the flood, when they finally came aground. Now, you see this cross and all that there? That's not in the booklet. I put that there for you. Okay. That's not in the book. That's the only change I made to these slides, you know. So, but I just wanted to tell them that if the waters prevail, taking us to a closing period of the age, and the first date in which God intervenes on behalf of Israel is 1874. That's why I approached it for them. 74 days later takes you to 1948, a day for a year, that would be meaningful. And that 95 days after that comes the time when they looked out on the ground and they saw no water remaining. Now, it was still muddy out there, but the waters were dried up from the earth after those 95 days. Now, do you know the date when those waters were dried up? And Genesis, is it 8:13? It gives you an exact date. It was a New Year's Day, the first day of the first month of a brand new year. Now, yesterday we emphasized that a new year represents the beginning of a new age. And I think this represents the beginning of a new age too, when the curse is dried and the 1,000 years proceeds. Dave, you're looking it up. Did you see that verse? Maybe you didn't. I saw you poking some keys. That's all I saw. Okay, but I'll tell you, it's the first year, the first day of the first month of year number 601 of Noah's count. That means precisely to a day when the flood waters were dried, representing the curse that is dried up from the earth. It's exactly at the end of 600 years. Does that perhaps suggest the precise end of six millenniums as a small picture of the six millenniums? So you see how this is one testimony after another, after another. Now, I didn't see this myself. I know exactly who did. I was leading a study in San Diego midweek on this subject about the flood. And it was Brother Keith Kleppen and Brother Robin Rice that both brought this to my attention right in the middle of the study. I hadn't seen it. But there are some little peculiarities about this computation. I'm not going to talk about them here. But these are stunning conclusions that seem to correlate with everything else we've seen. Okay, getting to the end here, towards the end. Where are we here? Yeah, getting pretty close here. It just so happens that and if this is the 70 years for Babylon from 610 B.C. until 540 B.C., which I believe that it is, then that parallels the 70 years from 1878 to 1948. We've talked about that before. But what I didn't say before was that these next 95 years take you to Nehemiah, whose completion of the city of Jerusalem, I have long felt, is prophetic of the completion of New Jerusalem in Revelation. That means the completion of the church. And this was 95 years after these 70 years, 95 after 1948, would be 2043. So the things that I think are meaningful here is not just the count of 6,000 years, but the interweaving to that of other testimonies that show the same thing by these other types and pictures. We got at least three times this 95 years from 1948 to the kingdom appears. Now we're going through a little quickly. I see even some of the most apt minds here are drifting just a little bit. So I know that this is kind of, you know, over the top a little bit, partly. But you've got it all in the booklet. It's all there. Remember, it's written for a Jewish audience. We're going to summarize here. Summary. This is what's been going on and what's coming. That's it. We started in 1874. We went all the way down through 1904. These are the things that have been happening all indicated in the time parallels of the Old Testament, even these difficult periods of Hitler and the Holocaust, and then down to the independence, to Jerusalem in 1967, and finally to the kingdom. We'll see. Now, for the non-Jewish audience, for the Christian audience, this is the last slide I've got. Is it? I always end with a chart. There it is. So I know that that's the last slide. So, what's ahead of us? What's coming whereby we might see whether this is on track or not? Well, you know probably what I'm going to say. Acts chapter 27. This I got from Ray Luke 30, 40 years ago. Ray Luke was mentioned you mentioned him yesterday. Dear precious soul. I remember when I was immersed, I was 16 years old. I was at the LA convention. He came to San Diego and he spoke to our midweek class. And you know, Brother Ray, he's that way. Took a little time before his talk to talk about this young brother, just to give him some encouraging comments, you know. So Ray was very dear. It was from his talk that I got the thought that Acts chapter 27 might be a picture of the time of trouble leading you right to the crash of the ship of state with Armageddon at the end of the harvest. And you come back, you know that storm that finally ruined that ship? 14 days. Does that storm represent a day for a year, 14 years? I think so. We'll see. But if that's true, what's coming back 14 years from the kingdom? 2029, 10 years away. 10 years. We'll see. We'll see if anything develops or whether nothing develops. But it seems to me that this is another marker that we can look for. What else can we look for? Ezekiel 38 and 39. You've got five countries that are the allies of Gog from the north. We'll see how those shape up. Turkey, Togarma, looks like they're coming into the sphere against Israel more than they were before. Persia, they're already there. Libya, they're in a mess. I don't know how they're going to interface. There was Kush. I always thought that was northern Black Africa. Maybe it's Yemen. I understand it could be an Arabic Kush. They're kind of going into the Persian sphere. We'll see. And the last one, Gomer. Jim Parkinson knows more about this than I do. He says Gomer is that tribe that went from the north of the Black Sea farther north and became Germany. Germany fanned out with all its tribes and inhabited Western Europe. Even the French, you know, sometimes they have a problem with the Germans. They're Franks. They're a Germanic tribe themselves. They're all Germanic tribes. So we'll see how this shapes up. Somebody says that Brexit is going to have dire consequences. I don't know. We're at the threshold. We're looking. We'll see what happens. But, you know, 10 years from now, I'm going to be looking really, really closely. And we'll see. We'll just see. What's happening between now and then? Well, we don't know.